difficult for me to believe, because to change the bulk temperature of the chest on a human being is not as easy as you think. I can lay the human being flat on the sand on the beach on a summer day where the sun is giving you 1,300 watts per square meter, and is about a square meter of your body absorbed to the sunlight. Let me drop. So I am pumping 1,300 watts of solar energy into your body when you lay on the beach in the summertime with your bathing suit. And the way the cooling of your body operates, the way you change the capillary dilation of near the skin, and the way you evaporate water and whatever. If I measured with a good thermometer, if I measured your body temperature before you laid in the sun and after you've been in the sun for half an hour, I'll be amazed that there's more than 1 degree Fahrenheit change in your body temperature. The thermal regulation of a human being is extremely tightly regulated. And if you go more than a couple of degrees above or below above temperature of a human being, that human being is going to feel it in a hurry and start applying corrective action. He's going to start complaining, hey, it's too hot or too cold, I got to get out of here. So you can see I'm having trouble believing that possible scenario. Paul, you better hurry up before we get into another subject. WS2N, what has NASA been doing lately? WS2N, I hope you're still with us. KQLIW on the TechNet.
Hey, Dick, WS2N. Very good. And I'm riveted to these topics. Very good topics tonight. I didn't let the courtesy tones go long enough yet. Okay, you know, a couple of topics with the space part of the net. One thing is these ion engines. This is on the NASA site recently. The next generation of ion engines have passed a five-year test. They ran one of these things for 43,000 hours, and they plan on eventually using this for the next generation of spacecraft that are going to go into deep space. They've used these ion engines before, you know, Dick. They have used it on the deep space one spacecraft. They had an ion engine, and then they took three of them and they put them on the one that went to Vista, and it's going to go off to Sirius, and the Dawn spacecraft. Now let me drop it. Now this one's called the NEXT. It's the NASA Evolution Array Xeon Thruster. So they give it a nice name, but essentially it's twice the power of the first ion engines. Again, the first one, you know, it had a certain power to it, the Deep Space One. If you took a piece of paper and you put it in your hand, that's how much thrust it had. And these things run for years on end. And then they took three of them and they put them on the Dawn spacecraft. And when I first read that years ago, I thought, well, okay, it's going to have three times the amount of power, but what they do is they just one run engine for like, you know, maybe a year or something, and then they'll shut it down, and then they'll use another one, and they don't put all three on at the same time, so you know, they never get three times the amount of thrust. So when they put these things on future spacecraft, they'll get it'll be fine if they put down put on three engines, then they'll have twice the amount of power than they have for Dawn. Now Dawn, you know, that's way out there. It went into orbit around Vista, and back in August it left, and it's on its way to Sirius, to the asteroid bodies. And these things are out of 2AU, way past the Mars orbit. Mars is around 1.6 AU, so it takes about half hour to send a signal at the speed of light. get to these things. We drop. So I'm fascinated by the gas that they use. It's amazing that the difference between the chemical engines and these things, that they were to make a chemical engine and to send it to a distant body like that, you'd have to have a huge rocket to do it with all the, you know, heavy amount of fuel, and it would be kind of cost prohibitive, especially for these types of missions. You know, they go out there, they can go into orbit and actually leave the orbit. You'd never be able to afford to do that. With these things, the engine comes on, it stays on for years on end, never shuts off. So, I mean, they do have hydrogen thrusters on board for orientation, but the primary propulsion is this xenon gas. And they put like this next engine that we're building. I mean, the fuel, the weight of it is only, like they've used up 43,000 hours of fuel, and they've only gone through, less than 2,000 pounds of xenon fuel. And it's really in liquid form, and then it turns into a gas, and gets ionized, shot out the back as thrust. Right now they use solar panels for future missions. There's none dedicated yet, but in future. And the main goal is to get them out sharp, which is about, if they were to do it driving day in, day out, it would be about 6 months from now before they would get there to really look for what they went there for, and that's to look for an organic type of carbon evidence, if they could find, you know, something like that. They would know that at one time they had the capability, that still not conclusive proof, but at least the capability would be there to have, you know, to have supported life. And they think down by the foothills of this mountain, they might find what they're looking for. So the scientists will have a ball once they do that. But it's not going to take 6 months. It's going to be more like 9 months, they say, because they want to stop on the way and investigate this rock, investigate that, run a test here, run a test there. So, but their main goal is, and has always been, is to get to the foothills of Mount Sharp. They had two main topics I wanted to bring up for the space nets at the end of the year. Back to you, Dick. This is WS2N.
Zed, if anyone on the net is copying, we've lost the net through the 9126 reflector. Say again, we've lost the net through the 9126 reflector.
Yeah, it's we did have some kind of a failure. For about a 3 or 4 minute period there, Paul, in the middle of your transmission, your audio was coming out of your transmitter beautifully. I listened on the input on 146.25, but the audio was not coming out. And I see now that the 147 dot transmitter is reset. It was also unset there for a while. And maybe there is a relation. The person out of area who is telling us that the audio has stopped, has it been restored? Go ahead and give me that information. K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is VE3ZTZ Scott in Toronto. I am copying you, Dick. Yes. I still haven't heard anyone else, though.
Very fine, Scott. I can tell it's been obvious by the fact that I'm now hearing the 147. I think there's a correlation. See, we have two repeaters down here, 146 megs and 147 megs. And when the two of them are coupled and audio is coming out of both, usually the link on IRLP and Echo Link is also working at the same time. And they did time out in the middle of that transmission. And also your audio simultaneously disappeared. I think there's a correlation there. So let me drop one for a second. So we did hear your report with reference to the ion engine, Paul, and we heard your report at the end about Curiosity looking for life on Mars. In between, though, there was some information for about 3 or 4 minutes that did get dropped. With reference to the ion engine, when it comes to efficiency of a thrusting engine in space, there's a parameter called specific impulse. That's a really function of how much thrust you get in pounds for how many hours, so to speak, versus how much fuel you use. In the case of a chemical engine, I don't know the exact number, but I'm going to guess the particles come out of that nozzle at something like 3,000 feet per minute. 3,000 feet per second is what I'm trying to say. Whereas in the case of an ion engine, the particles come out of there a lot closer to the speed of light, probably one quarter or one half the speed of light. So although the total amount of thrust you get out of an ion engine is many, many times smaller, the total efficiency of how much mass you consume in the engine versus how many pound hours of thrust you get are hugely better. So when it comes to significant distances with spacecraft, particularly when they are nuclear powered, I suspect that ion engine is going to be the future. Let me pass it back to you for some comments on that one first, Paul. Do they give you a ratio sometimes of how much more efficient in pounds consumed versus thrust hours of pounds, thrust hours of ion engine versus chemical engine? WS2N, K2LIW and TechNet. Wait for the four beeps. Not necessarily. I recommend you go back to, with the current aiming of your antenna, you're a little bit noisy, Sue Selden, so go back to the western input pole. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm back. Very good. In the middle of the transmission, I was probably talking about the, not the numbers, but it wouldn't even be affordable to use a chemical engine to do what they want to do, to send these things out to the asteroid belt and beyond for these type of missions, and then orbit and go off and deorbit and go off to orbit. Sirius, it's just not possible. Pacific Impulse is gigantic compared to the chemical engines. You know, you get 2, 3, 4 minutes of all this fuel being dumped, millions of pounds of fuel being dumped. Don't forget, for every launch you watch, you know, you're looking at over 90% of the weight is going to be lost between the rocket itself, you know, the weight of the rocket, the fuel compared to the payload. It's unbelievable. You know, it's just, like 5 million pounds, 5 rockets that took everybody to the moon, and 3 people to the moon, and a lander. I think it was, 40,000 pound spacecraft that landed on the moon, plus the command module. You know, and here's this 5 million pound thing sitting on the launch pad. Now you can take a spacecraft like Dawn, I think that one had about 1,000 pounds of fuel on board, and go all the way out to the asteroid belt. Let me drop it. That tells me a lot there. That is the way to go. And twice the power on these new engines, we'll be able to send future spacecraft to Saturn or Jupiter. And now they want to send a spacecraft to Europa, and that's completely covered with ice. Eventually land the spacecraft there and dig through the ice. They got all these exotic plans for doing that. Maybe even send a submersible craft under the ice in the future. But to get there, it would be a lot cheaper to send it by ion engine with radioisotope thermoelectric generators producing the power. You're going to get a lot more long-lasting, much, much more power out of that than you're going to get out of the solar spacecraft. Dawn has, in the Earth orbit, has 10 kilowatts, 10 kilowatts of power, and then you get out to the asteroid belt, and it's only 1,000 watts are really being put into that craft to operate the ion engine. And of course, the equipment, it does have two 100 amplifiers, traveling wave tube amplifiers on board, and I think a 6-foot dish antenna, and half a dozen different cameras, radar detectors, and all. So, I mean, it does run that, but it only runs out a little bit of the time compared to the ion engine, which runs year in, year out. So, pretty good. Back to you, Dick.
Of the ion engines we have in space right now, Paul, is the raw electrical energy to run them coming from solar cells or radioactive thermal generators? And how much of each? Is every one of the ion engine crafts in space, which is the raw source of power? Are all of them on solar? Are all of them on nuclear? Or is there a mixture? WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, they've really only done it with 3 spacecraft so far. You have the Spot 1 was one, Deep Space 1, and Dawn. Spot 1 was done by European Space Agency. So those 3, and they were all solar powered, but they have plans on running them with RTGs. The deep space missions. You get out to Saturn and Jupiter, the solar panels have to be huge. I mean, not that they can't do it. You've got the Juno mission right now on the way to Jupiter, but the panels are 120 feet. There's 3 sets of them to supply the power for that spacecraft. That's not an RTG. They wanted to do that. It's not going to be a long mission like Galileo. Galileo, which orbited Jupiter for, half a dozen years or more. That was an RTG. Cassini, that's an RTG. All your deep space missions, your Pioneers and your Voyages and your... Now your New Horizon going to Pluto, all RTGs, back to you.
Okay, in the beginning we had a lot of satellites running on solar cells, particularly the ones that are in geosynchronous orbit for communication purposes. I think almost all of them are solar powered, solar voltaics. Now that the radioactive thermal generators are working so well on things like Curiosity and these missions to Jupiter and Saturn, what would not stop us from using radioactive thermal generators forever on anything that goes beyond, let me say, Mars? What would motivate us today to ever use solar panels again, anything beyond Mars, Paul? Because the weight and difficulty of deployment of these 100-foot-long solar panels, I mean, that's eating up a lot of potential payload. It looks to me like you get a lot more bang for the dollar out of radioactive thermal generators. So, for deep space, is there any motivation to ever again use solar panels? WS2N, K2LAW, go ahead, Paul.
Well, it depends on the mission. The cost of the RTGs might be expensive. So maybe it's a cost effective for a reason. I know longevity is one. You've got Curiosity on Mars. That's an RTG running on plutonium. And that'll probably run for many, many years up there. I mean, its primary mission is 2 years, to give you an idea. 2 Earth years, I mean, they landed in 2004, and one of them is still going. The other one quit in 2010, back in March. Spirit. So, I mean, they really got a lot of value out of those two spacecraft. Long duration missions. The Ulysses mission, when that thing went around the polar orbit of the sun, you needed an RTG for that. That went off in, I don't know, decades. Depending on the power, I think, and most importantly, how long you drop it. The Juno mission to Jupiter, that's going to be 33 orbits, polar orbit. And that's it. That's all they need. You won't see an extended mission on that. So to send an RTG on that wasn't really worth it. But to build the solar panels, 120 feet long, and just have to worry about them opening, and they really got pretty good at that. I think it's less expensive. It's probably a cost ratio type of thing. That's my guess, Dick. Anything beyond the asteroids, you really need to run an RTG. The European Space Agency sent there's something called the Rosetta, and that's still on its, I think it's going to get to its destination, some comet in 2016 that was probably launched 15 years ago or something. That solar panel, bigger than Juno. Would they think, probably, I think if they thought it over, if it was now that they launched it, I think they'd probably run an RTG for a mission like that. Back to you, Jeff.
When it comes to a long duration mission, like visiting these two asteroids of Vista and Sirius, or whatever it's pronounced, where you're changing the trajectory after you visit one and you go to another, so you want a lot of thrust for a lot of time, ion engine does a beautiful job. A chemical engine gives you a whole lot of thrust for a very brief period of time. Ion engine gives you very little thrust for a lot of time. When it comes to efficiency in specific impulse, have they ever quoted a ratio that the ion engine in specific impulse is X number of times more efficient than a chemical engine? And is the difference like 50 to 1, for instance, Paul? In other words, you get for the same number of pounds of fuel that you consume, and you multiply the number of pounds of thrust times the number of hours you get that thrust, do you come out 50 to 1 ahead with an ion engine versus a chemical engine? I just picked that number out of the air, and I wonder if NASA has ever quoted such a number, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
I definitely read it, and if it was 5 years ago, or probably before that, probably with Deep Space One, the one that went to the comet, the first one that they tried, that was really an experimental mission just to see how good the ion engine worked, and it worked great. So they put three on Dawn. Back in those days, probably, that was 1990, I'm going to guess 1998 when that thing was launched, Deep Space One. And I think that ran for probably 4 or 5 years. I'm sure I read it back then, and I definitely remember the specific impulse, and they gave it a ratio, but that's all it is, a ratio, and compare that to anything else. I don't know what the number is. I wouldn't be surprised if it was way over. It's got to be 80 or 90% more efficient. It's nothing. It's like taking, to me, it's like taking an electron gun from a cathode ray tube and breaking the glass. Not a perfect analogy, but running a TV tube, CRT for 5, 10 years or something, and never shutting it off. Back to you, Dick.
that the ratio is somewhat dependent on nozzle escape velocity. In other words, if the chemical engine gives you particles squirting out of that nozzle at 3,000 feet per second, and if the ion engine gives you particles squirting out of the nozzle at half the speed of light, and I look at those velocities in feet per second, I am guessing that's close to the ratio. To your knowledge, have they ever stated nozzle escape particle velocity, Paul? Have they ever put it in those terms in anything you've read so far? WS2N, K2RIW?
I'm giving the specific impulse numbers. And I also remember the speed, and it wasn't half the speed of light. Now it's I guess that would be like if you were shooting electrons out, you know, maybe you're going to get that. But these are pretty much protons. They use xenon gas, and I think it's got something like 50-some-odd atoms around the nucleus. So, you know, once that's ionized, you're really taking a heavy nucleus. It's really protons that they're blasting out. It's not really... I'm interested in the electrons. Well, electron is 1800 to 1 ratio to a proton. So, you know, for every xenon atom you're shooting out, that's like 50 some odd protons, you know, one atom. So it's relatively heavy. That's why they use the xenon gas. You know, I mean, anything would work. You know, you could ionize, you know, any of the lighter gases, any of the lighter liquids. You know, I mean, if you have a gas and blast them out of a engine. You know, even mercury would work. But you know, these are all. You know, a lot of the gases are on. They're not inert. You know, xenon gas and inert. Well, they always believed it was inert, but back in the 60s or something, some scientists did manage to combine it with something else. But, you know, it can be combined. But basically, it's inert. It doesn't affect anything else on a spacecraft. You can put it in any kind of a tank. It is liquid. Yeah. Not corrosive.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
BZZZ with information.
You did time out the machine. It looks like everything is reset, though. Yeah, from all I can tell. New Horizons is the one that's heading for Pluto. And so my final question to you, Paul, how is New Horizons doing? And I've forgotten, but how many years before it arrives on target? And I think it's going to do a couple of gravity assist maneuvers with some of the planets between here and Jupiter, here and Pluto. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay. I can't believe I timed this thing out. Can I see? New Horizon is fly at this past Jupiter. It's just over halfway there. So you're looking at, what, 20... I believe, I think it's 2015, I'll have to check. Last time I looked was a couple of months ago when it got past the halfway point. But I think it's 2015, it'll be passing Pluto. It comes within, I think within 2,000 miles of the planet. And it'll be viewing it, you know, with its high telescopic cameras for roughly about 5 hours before it gets there and after. So it's got to do a lot of work. It's got to rotate. It's got to move as it's passing to get good pictures and all of that. So, and then after that, it's off to the Kuiper Belt.
So roughly 2015, New Horizons spacecraft gets to go to Pluto, but it's a flyby. It's too bad it doesn't have enough fuel on board to go in orbit around Pluto and take longer range measurements, but I can see why to have enough fuel to get all the way out there and then try to stop on the dime, very difficult. So there wasn't a chance to bring enough fuel to go into orbit. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
I think it weighs, I'm looking up, I don't know, I think it's a 1,500 pound thing. It's not a big heavy thing like Cassini or Galileo. Cassini going around Saturn and Galileo that went around Jupiter. Much smaller than that. But to get that speed to do what they wanted to do, they put it on the heaviest booster that we had, the Atlas. Atlas V, and they put 5 boosters on board that, so it was the, you know, that's the most they could put on. And when they took, when that thing took off, give you an idea, Curiosity, the same rocket, but they only used 4 boosters. I mean, so New Horizon, they put everything, they, whatever they had, they put the pedal to the metal to get that out there. I'll have to check on the year. I think it's 2015. We won't miss it, Dick. I'll remind you when it gets there. I remember when that thing took off, they had an interview with the people, let me drop it, that were involved in launching this thing, and, you know, the science people behind it. We're all very young, and they were talking about, you know, it was going to take 12 years or something to get there. And that they were going to be a lot older when it got there. What a way of thinking, back to you.
So New Horizons is going to zip by Pluto, take a whole lot of pictures as it flies by, then go off to the Kuiper Belt, or the Oort Cloud, or both. What's your guess, Paul? When it finishes flying by Pluto, will it be faster or slower in miles per hour compared to Voyager? And Voyager, I think, is out there now at something like 120 astronomical units, almost 3 times the distance of Pluto. Pluto was launched way back in, I think, 1976. That makes it, what, 30, lots of years ago, 37 or so years ago. So, do you think New Horizons, after it flies by Pluto, will it be a similar velocity of leaving this solar system compared to Voyager? Will it also have the ability to make a whole bunch of measurements out there of solar wind, magnetic fields, and get another picture of what the outer edge of our solar system is really like? WS2N, K2LAW.
It's going to be a lot slower. The voyages are roughly 40,000, I think 38,000, but roughly 40,000 miles per hour away from the sun, you know, relative to the sun, and that changes with the Earth. You know, you can't go by the Earth because when the Earth is going toward, you know, for instance, toward the direction of New Horizon, it's going, you know, 66,000 miles per hour in that direction, and then when it's going away, it's going 66,000 miles away from it. So you can never use the Earth as a reference. So they use the sun roughly 40,000 miles away per hour away from the sun, and New Horizons is going to be a lot less than that, a half or something like that. But it doesn't have the speed, it doesn't have the longevity that Voyager 1 and 2 have. It's not going to be used for detecting the solar winds in the future. None of that is planned. In fact, what's planned is eventually they'd like to send it out to one or two type of belt objects. You know, there's a bunch of them out there. There's Sedna, that's one. These things roll 40 or 50 or even 60 AU out, you know, way past Pluto. Sedna, another one called Makemake that was discovered a couple of few years back. Relatively large objects, you know, some of them are maybe as close to the size of Pluto. So they've got plans on, future plans on where this thing's going to go, but then it, They're not talking about me.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And WS1, I think it might go.
So, it's going to fly by Pluto and then possibly go to Sedna. I think Sedna is one of the Kuiper Belt projects that either is the same size or even slightly larger than Pluto. I know that when I listened to Neil deGrasse Tyson justifying why he was one of the main people voting for Pluto to no longer be considered a planet, but to be considered a planetismal, it's because they were starting to discover a whole lot of other objects out there, in many cases bigger than Pluto. And if we didn't make that a non-planet, all of a sudden the so-called number of planets of Pluto would start climbing to, number of planets of the solar system would start climbing to very high numbers, and it would be hard to keep track of it all. On top of that, Pluto is considerably smaller than a large number of the moons going around the other eight planets. So it was more and more difficult to justify keeping Pluto as a planet, even though there's a lot of Pluto lovers. Let me drop.
I believe Scott from Toronto had a comment.
Yeah, very good. I was about to ask. Let me drop. Yeah. While we've got Paul, our space person here, space expert, anyone else with other questions for Paul? I shouldn't be dominating all of the questions. So, Scott, go right ahead with your question. K2RIW in the tech net.
TZ, Scott in Toronto, Canada. It's not a question, it's a comment. I just have the JPL website up here, and I was going to I have the numbers for your specific impulse. Don's engines have a specific impulse of 3100 F and a thrust of 90 millinewtons, while a chemical rocket on a spacecraft might have a thrust of up to 500 newtons. Don's much smaller engine achieves an equivalent trajectory change by firing over a much longer period of time. And there's some graphs and things that go along with that. So the SI, Don's engines, is 3100S. I'm not sure what the unit S is. And thrust of 90 millinewtons. Chemical engine would be 500 newtons. B3 says that back to net.
Yeah, very good there, Scott. I think the units of specific impulse, believe it or not, are in seconds. It's a whole bunch of pluses and minuses and divisions and whatever to finally get the final unit. So 3,100 seconds is the specific impulse of an ion engine with 90 millinewtons. So if I divide 0.09 into 500, I'm going to get roughly 5,000. So there's a 5,000-to-1 ratio of thrust, but we still don't know the specific impulse of the chemical engine. So 3,100 seconds for the ion engine, and it's going to take a little more digging, I think, Scott, to find out the specific impulse of the chemical engine. VE3ZTZ, K2RIW in the TechNet. Thank you for that info. Go ahead, Scott.
There is a graph that plots all the propulsion methods from electric propulsion, which ranges from ion to magnetic, and H2 electrothermal, solar H2, nuclear, antimatter, and laser, and then a chemical overlay. And at 0.09, it looks like, if I'm interpreting this correctly, the specific impulse is somewhere around equivalent. It's going to be around 210, 250, if that makes any sense. I can email you the link, and you can have a look at this yourself. D3ZTZ back to net.
Very fine, Scott. Okay, we're zeroing in on the difference. And obviously, if you've got a long mission with a lot of thrusting required to go between various targets, like these individual asteroids, the ion engine is the way to go. A chemical engine can give you a whole lot of thrust, but it burns through it awful fast. You carry a lot of heavy stuff with you called fuel. When the Saturn V took off on the Apollo mission, you had roughly 5 million pounds of stuff on that launch pad and roughly 7 million pounds of thrust out of those 5 engines. A lot of energy. And you're burning up fuel at thousands of pounds per minute. And of that 5 million pounds of takeoff, the actual payload that got to the moon is a few tens of thousands of pounds. So the rest of it was all the fuel to do all the stuff that got burned. If they ever finish making, really do and make a space elevator, this great big long ribbon going to a counterweight out there in space, and then you build these vehicles that climb that ribbon, we can save these tremendous amounts of fuel, because the biggest chunk of fuel in most of these space missions, let me drop this, the biggest amount of fuel is spent just climbing out of this gravity well that we call Earth to get into near Earth orbit is a big feat. And when you go over to the moon, you climb back down into a small gravity well called moon, and you only went there with the lunar module, and then took off from there and left your major spacecraft, the command module, and its service module. You left that in orbit around the moon. Didn't have to bring it down and up. It's amazing that the early science fiction, you had this great big rocket that went straight to the moon and back down onto the moon and came back to Earth. Good, simplistic science fiction. You really studied the energy consumption to do that. If we had decided to do that on the Apollo mission, I think the Saturn V would have had to be 5 or 10 times bigger than it was. Can you imagine making a spacecraft, a launching vehicle, 5 or 10 times bigger than something that already has 7 million pounds of thrust, and the total takeoff vehicle was something like 320 feet high, 32-story building was on that launch pad. Can you imagine making something 5 or 10 times bigger just because you hadn't invented lunar orbit rendezvous? Let me drop.
They thought of that, Dick.
Yeah, I'm going to turn it over to you in a minute, Dan Paul. What was amazing is that the best science advisors that John F. Kennedy had before he made his pronouncement, we're going to go to the moon and safely bring him back to Earth, he made that pronouncement at a time that his experts thought we could do it, and if a few years downrange, some little old engineer, some damn smart engineer at Grumman Aircraft hadn't invented lunar orbit rendezvous, where only a small portion of the spacecraft goes down to the lunar surface, the majority stays in orbit. If that hadn't been invented, I know the Saturn V didn't stand a chance in hell of doing it, and it would have had to been made hugely bigger. So tell me how much bigger, if you happen to know, Paul, WS2N, how much more impossible would it have been? K2LIW in the Tech Night, you got it, Paul.
Yeah, it was going to be twice. It was going to be twice the size. There's no way. And they knew it. Just to even have to stand under its own weight on the launch bed, that never got going. I think they called it Nova. I looked that up, Nova. It actually had a name for it. But yeah, that went away. The second they realized the cost would be phenomenal. The gravity on, I want to mention the asteroids. You've got the gravity well here. If you weigh, whatever you weigh here on Earth, it would be only 3% on those two asteroids. And you had two asteroids, even so, is one is twice as bigger in diameter. Sirius is bigger. The gravity is still about the same because the density small one happens to be twice the density, so it's a very strange setup between the two asteroids. So it's very easy to get out of orbit, putting ion engines. We drop it.
And by the way, Paul, do tell us roughly what's the arrival date at Vista and Cirrus of the Dawn spacecraft. Over to you, Paul. Wait for the beeps.
Okay, Vista, it's already been in orbit and left, and left this year, back in August, was the departure date for Vista, and now you've got another year before it gets to Cirrus. Even so, it was launched in 2007. Officially, it's only gone around the Earth a little over two times. And you would think, well, 5 years going around and around, well, it should be at least, you know, four or five times around. But it's only gone around twice because the orbit changes. I mean, they use Mars as a gravity assist to get it going faster. Weird that it's only gone around the sun twice, but once you get out toward Mars and beyond, it's really way beyond Mars now. The time it takes to get around the sun is really increased. Look at Mars. Mars and Earth is roughly 2 to 1. You know, just for every 1 year of Earth, it takes 2 years for Mars to do that, and what Dawn is now, and it takes a lot longer. Back to you, Dick.
I wish I remembered the exact number. I'm going to give you very approximate numbers of an article of NASA's I was reading a week or two ago. Each of these spacecraft where we do a gravity assist, when you do a near flyby of Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, and so on, and your spacecraft gets a great big boost of energy to go on to a mission further out, and you get a hell of a lot of energy free of charge compared to using a thrusting engine. Because of Newton's third law, action and reaction, your spacecraft is gaining a lot of energy in that flyby. Where is it coming from? It's coming from the planet. As you take your 20,000 pound spacecraft and do a boost as you fly it by the planet, and it's now moving a hell of a lot faster in some slightly different direction after the flyby, the planet has been slowed down. You get no free lunch, action and reaction. But these planets, of course, by comparison, are extremely massive. Let me drop. I forget which one of the missions they're talking about, one of the bigger missions and one of the flybys. And I think they came to the conclusion that because the flyby gained energy to the spacecraft and lost energy to the planet, that the slowdown of the planet is such that after 1,000 years, the exact position the planet is going to be in is going to be 1/16 of an inch different. Not easy to measure, but it is calculatable, it is real. But I think about exponential mathematics, even though the exponent might be a huge ratio of the difference of the mass of your spacecraft versus the mass of the planet. And it's that ratio that's approximately the difference in the velocities. So 1,000 years later, Jupiter or Mars is going to be 1/8 of an inch or so in a different position. I wonder if you remember reading that one, Paul, WS2NTQLIW.
Yeah, that was Jupiter. I remember that. They talked about when Cassini went past that it would officially be slowing down Jupiter. But yeah, that happens with any of them. And in fact, you could use a planet to slow yourself down, like Mariner did. Messenger going around orbit right now around Mercury when it went past Venus. They use it to slow it down, and then by doing that, you're actually speeding that planet up.
Yeah, if you fly by the backside of the planet, so to speak, in its orbit, you get speeded up. If you fly by the front side of the planet, you get slowed down. I think that's roughly what happens. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons we talked about New Horizons going around the front side. Once it, you know, once to have the light from the sun shining on the planet, you've got to go in front of it. And they've got to take all these pictures. It will actually be slowing down when it goes past Pluto. Even so, when it went past Jupiter, it used Jupiter as a gravity assist to speed it up. And it doesn't. I mean, it really gets a lot of miles. I'm talking about 3,000-4,000 mile blast per hour every time these things do that when they go past Jupiter.
I'm getting a beautiful picture. I'm glad you mentioned this to me. So if we chose to fly by Pluto with New Horizons in such a way that the velocity got boosted, it'd be flying by the backside of Booster, and most of your flyby would be on the far side of Pluto, the dark side, and there'd be very little to photograph unless you got one hell of a floodlight. And from 1,000 miles away, forget it. You can't generate enough light. So by flying by in front of Pluto, the sunlit side, you get some beautiful photography, but now you're flying by the front side and then going around the forward, the sun side and then the forward side of Pluto, and so you're going to be slowed down a whole lot by Pluto by a few thousand miles an hour. Therefore, you're still leaving the solar system, but a hell of a lot slower than Voyager, and now I see the mechanism. Everything's a trade-off. Good pictures or good velocity, you can't have it both ways. Ha! Anyone else with any further questions on the subject of space? Because if not, I'm suddenly remembering a question that Wes asked 3 or 4 weeks ago about Transformers. And I came up with an interesting conclusion on that one. So on the subject of space, before we leave about Paul, anybody got any further questions or comments? Give me your call letters right now. K2LAW and the TechNet.
Into my problem.
Go ahead, Barry. Wait for the beeps and you got it.
I don't know if you guys brought it up tonight. I think you touched on it, though. Has there been any further progress with the, I guess you call it the space elevator, or you know what I'm talking about, though. It's the project that they talked about a lot about 5 years ago to bring things into space by using a kind of a lift system with a elevator kind of a thing. And I haven't heard anything about it anymore. So can we get some information on that if anybody's got it? And 2MB.
I'm going to turn it over to Paul in a minute. I'm going to tell you what my remembrance was. The space elevator really is a ribbon of extremely high strength materials, way beyond what you can normally get with carbon graphite reinforced materials, which is anchored to, let's say, a ocean-bearing vessel very close to the equator. And you probably have some kind of a compensating mechanism that as the ship goes up and down, you're reeling in and reeling out this ribbon to make sure you're not tugging on it. The ribbon goes up to a counterweight that is way beyond Earth's synchronous orbit. Earth's synchronous orbit is 22,300 miles out, and that would give you a neutral force. If you go, let me pick a number, another 20,000 miles further out with the weight held with this ribbon, you now have got a lot of force on the ribbon as you're whipping it around the Earth. You know what happens when you take a string and a ball and you swing your hand just the right way so the ball on the end of the string is running continuously in a circle and there's a certain tension on your hand. Well, that's sort of what you're doing with the space elevator. You've got a weight out there way beyond synchronous orbit, and the Earth's rotation is the whip. Let me drop. But in order for that system to fly, you need a ribbon that's made out of something that is super strong and super light, because the majority of the tension on the ribbon is the support of the weight of the ribbon that's inside of the synchronous orbit altitude. So it takes extreme strength of materials. Let me pick a number. 40,000 miles of it and if you get one little glitch somewhere in the ribbon that develops a tear, the whole thing goes down the tubes. No one has yet worked out the problem of what happens if a hurricane hits the ribbon, what happens if a comet or an asteroid or an airplane strikes the ribbon. There's a zillion ways it can fail. A lot of expense, beautiful potential benefit, but a lot of resources required to establish it, and it's got a lot of vulnerability. So on paper, it's a good-looking project. To actually go and do it, I'm a little worried that your grandchildren in their lifetime might not see it happen. Although, the rate at which we're developing graphene-like materials could suddenly make a breakthrough. Those are some of my first impressions. Paul, you've been studying it a lot more than I have. What's the status of the space elevator? WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, a couple of years ago they were having competitions. They set up a cable with a big crane and people were trying to compete how high or how fast. They had to see how fast they can get their spacecraft up this rod and this wire. And they were using laser beams to energize them. And, I don't know. It's just, you know, that's one of the things too, you know, how to power this thing. Talk of using laser beams to power this craft that's going to go up the wire, but I haven't really heard that there's no hardware that I know that's involved, even if it's, you know, any kind of testing. It would be monumental project to build something like this. I think the closest I'm going to see to it is in one of my books, 2061 by Arthur C. Clarke. Talks a lot about the space elevator and how it's utilized. Good book. That's about as close as I'm going to get to seeing the space elevator, I think. Dick, back to you.
Yeah, some of the vulnerability of that space elevator ribbon is that right now the strongest materials we can ever dream about are graphene-like materials. In other words, these hexagonal assembly of individual carbon molecules is the strongest material, that call it diamond if you like, diamond-like material. One single layer of carbon granules with this hexagonal arrangement makes an extremely strong material. That's a good piece of news. Extremely high thermal conductivity material. That could be good news. Extremely high electrical conductivity material. That could be bad news. What happens if a thunderstorm with lightning bolts hits your ribbon? That lightning bolt, if it's a positive charged cloud lightning bolt, it can easily issue a quarter of a million amperes into your ribbon. Is your ribbon going to survive that? So the number of ways the ribbon can fail: lightning bolt, tornado, thunderstorm, aircraft impact, just plain oscillation modes from various things or whatever. And how in the world do you establish it in the first place? If you do get it, you can now launch material into space at 1/1000th the cost in dollars per pound. On top of that, if you allow your device, let me drop it. If you allow your device that climbs the ribbon, the space elevator vehicle, if you allow it to go out closer and closer to the counterweight, beyond synchronous orbit, you're now considerably increasing the energy you inject into that item. It's a way of slingshotting a spacecraft outside of the Earth's orbit. That counterweight out there wants to leave this planet, except that you're tethering it to the Earth's surface. So you allow your climber to climb all the way out there, and you're slingshotting your spacecraft into space without requiring thrust. So it's got a lot of advantages if you can do it. But establishing it is way beyond the strength of material, strength-to-weight ratio and resiliency of currently known materials. I think you see the degree of difficulty here. M2MB. Back to you, Barry. And all we got to... It would be nice if we could first invent anti-gravity. In fact, you listen to some of these Neil deGrasse Tyson, Tyson interviews. Quite often, some fairly smart young kid in the audience will say, where do we stand on anti-gravity machines? And right now, we can't even explain gravity. And so then take something you can't even explain and go on and use the philosophy, the technology to generate anti-gravity. It's nice science fiction, but I think that's way off in the future. Into Moonbound, KQRAW. Go ahead, Barry.
Okay. I think what you're telling me is the approach of putting an object in space and having it tethered, so to speak, from the ground, at this time is rather impractical. But the laser beam, I know they were working on that one, and I think the problem with that was they got very little lift for a very short distance. If I'm correct, that's the problem with the laser beam. So is that what's going on with that one? Over.
Now, the source of energy for the elevator mechanism, the thing that climbs the ribbon, you've got a zillion sources of energy there. You can put batteries, chemicals, solar cells, aim a laser beam from the ground. There's a zillion ways you can power the elevator climbing machine. That's not the major limitation. The ribbon itself and the method of suspending the ribbon and the great big counterweight at the far end of roughly twice synchronous orbit. Establishing that set of materials and putting it in the right place at the right time. If you and I, Barry, were trying to build a suspension bridge that went across the Atlantic Ocean, I think you can see a little bit of the degree of difficulty. Let's assume we wanted to make an arch. I'm going to make a great big stone arch that goes across the Atlantic Ocean. When you get it all together, the weight of the stones pushing against each other holds it. But can you imagine the intermediate scaffolding required to do that? You get some idea of how difficult it is, okay? Picture the scaffolding required to get the counterweight out there and to extend the ribbon between there and back down to Earth. It's a many, many step process. But the first few steps of establishing that space elevator counterweight plus ribbon, getting it there, you've got literally 40,000 miles of ribbon you've rolled up on some kind of a reel during some portion of that process.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
These are awfully big numbers. So, on paper, if you're naive, it may look simple. To really do it, wow. Now, Arthur C. Clarke, he's got a number of his futuristic articles in which, or books in which he talks about not only the space elevator, but you develop this great big ring near synchronous orbit around the whole Earth, and a number of spokes of that ring go down to the Earth's surface, and so they become the elevators by which you put people into this ring, and it becomes a whole habitat up there. I forget what he calls it, but that's a beautiful, fanciful thing, which is moving you in the direction of, I think Arthur C. Clarke or somebody else talked about, the stages of a civilization. Eventually, you start off with a civilization, let me drop, that the energy requirement for the civilization can be met by solar, wind, geothermal, chemical, you know, hydrocarbon fuel, you know, petroleum-like fuels. but eventually society says that that's nowhere near the amount of energy we need. So eventually you start building these great big wind farms, solar farms that cover up the whole surface of the earth. Well, as the society develops, eventually you get to the point where that ain't enough, and you start building some kind of a surface around the sun, and you're now trying to gather all of the energy that the sun can give you. I mean, you can dream about future societies that have energy requirements to start doing things like this. Good science fiction, can it really take place, is an interesting question. Over to you, Barry. NQLB, KQLAW.
Okay, you did get away from me a little bit there. I wasn't saying specifically that it had to be a wire or a carbon fiber. I know they were also working on a high-powered laser that could possibly lift something into space, and I know that's got its own problems. As far as I understand, the high-powered laser approach didn't get them very far, and not very fast also. It was not too practical. Have they made any progress with that? As I understand it, the last time I looked into that one, they got very few feet off the ground and not a lot of lift either. So what's happening with that? Over.
WS2N.
I'm going to go over to Paul in a minute. When I use my laser pointer, I'm shooting photons in one direction, sort of like a rifle, and in theory, there's a kickback. I'm getting some reverse thrust, but it's extremely